This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. I'm going to read to you right now the 26 words that, in the opinion of my guest today, created the internet as we either love it or hate it. So here goes, and I'm quoting, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider." That's it. That's the end of the quote. 26 words. Some of you may recognize that sentence as part of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a federal law that was passed in 1996 and governs a lot of what happens online. Section 230 grants broad immunity to websites and ISPs from legal actions, such as being sued for libel and defamation. So in the case of Reason, if you write something awful and defamatory in the comment section of Reason.com, and judging by the sheer volume of that, you probably have if you visited the site, you can get sued, but Reason probably can't. And Section 230 is the law that has enabled the internet to become driven by user-generated content, from whether we're talking about YouTube videos or Yelp reviews or and all sorts of other kinds of content. And now Section 230, and we're going to get into a long conversation about this, but it was once popular for instantiating the web, the World Wide Web, especially back in the 90s, as what folks back then used to call a temporary autonomous zone, where there was a hell of a lot of freedom and it was hard to make people stop doing what they're doing. They were going to create their own rules, create their own laws, create their own societies. But these days, Section 230 is under attack from both conservative politicians and liberal politicians. So people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, Republican senators, want to end 230 or talk about reining it in because it's a sweetheart deal that allows Facebook to suppress the popularity of Diamond and Silk. But on the other side, people like Elizabeth Warren and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi are against it because they think it allows too much unbridled speech from bad sources, including Russian trolls and whatnot that cost Hillary Clinton the election. Pelosi just a few days ago said that it might be time to get rid of it altogether as a way of regulating regulating social media more fully. So my guest today is Jeff Kossoff. He teaches law at the U.S. Naval Academy. He's a former journalist who was a Polk Award winner and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's the author of the urgent new book, The 26 Words That Created the Internet, which he calls a biography of Section 230. We're going to talk about the curious history of 230, the slow erosion of its sweep and kind of majesty as governing law on the internet, and how seriously and why we should take challenges to it and free expression on the internet so seriously. Jeff, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
So give me the elevator pitch of the book. I mean, it's right there in the title, so maybe it's, you know, we're just getting in, the doors don't even have to close. But, you know, what's the essence of your book and its argument?
So the essence of my book, and it is a biography of a statute that I started writing in 2016. I did not realize that it very well may end up being an obituary for the statute, and we can talk about that a bit later. Yeah. But the overall gist of the book is that there was a law that Congress really quietly passed as part of a much broader telecommunications bill more than 20 years ago. And that law is more responsible than I would believe any other social dynamic for creating the collaborative internet that we know today. And what the book tries to do is examine 20 years out what have been the positive, negative, and in-between impact, and where do we go from here as the internet becomes more complex, as technology companies become larger, and really get more of a focus in Washington, D.C. than they ever have before.
Before we talk about the history, let's talk about kind of how you talk about how Section 230 has really kind of defined the internet in a particular way. And at one point you mentioned looking, I think this was for 2018, of the top 10 internet sites, websites in the United States, only one of them, Netflix, mostly makes its own content. The rest are things like Facebook or Twitter or even Google, where, you know, Twitter and Facebook, it's all user-generated content. Google, in many ways, YouTube is owned by Google or Alphabet, obviously user-generated content. And then search engines are linking to kind of user-generated content. So explain how 230 created this internet, which is mostly, as you were saying, collaborative and mostly user-generated content.
So Section 230 provides a fairly strong defense for claims arising from user-generated content. And what that does is it allows platforms to rely on user content without fearing lawsuits, without fearing regulation. So if I were a Yelp or a Facebook or a Twitter that was starting out without Section 230, I'm not quite sure how I'd be able to operate in the same way, in the same open, collaborative way, because and this is a lawyer speaking, I would be terrified of the constant threat of lawsuits that you would face. And even if there wasn't much merit to lawsuits like defamation about someone's opinion, which clearly is not going to succeed, you would still have to go through the discovery process and litigate, which is very costly. So Section 230 has really set this framework that platforms are able to allow user content. And one of the other motivations of 230, which we can talk about, was to set their own rules and determine what they believe is appropriate.
Yeah, that's, you know, when you go back and read John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence in cyberspace or whatever, you know, it's all about, it's not about escaping morality. It's being in a place where you can kind of create your own terms and your own society and your own rules. Discuss a little bit the, so, you know, we have this thing, you know, the internet obviously predates the 90s, but and kind of by the mid 90s, the World Wide Web is burgeoning. What was the landscape like before the internet became kind of a dominant force in our lives or a regular presence? And you go through a bunch of the early kind of pre-230 cases, pre-Communications Decency Act, which was part of the Telecommunications Act, which rewrote kind of a lot of laws about communication technology. What was going on in the 80s and the early 90s with services like pre-internet services like Prodigy, AOL, and CompuServe?
Yeah, so there was a rule under the First Amendment that goes back to the 1950s involving bookstores that were being prosecuted for selling what was believed to be obscene books, that the distributor of content could only be held liable if the distributor knew or should have known of the illegal content. So if a bookstore had 15,000 books, then most likely you're not going to hold the bookstore owner liable. So that worked pretty well through the 1980s, early 90s. And then we started to have these services that, shockingly, none of my students were around to remember. CompuServe and Prodigy were the two earliest ones, and they took very different approaches. So CompuServe provided newsletters, forums, all sorts of both one-way and two-way types of communications media, and it basically did not do any moderation. It did not set any rules, didn't have anyone looking at content. Prodigy, on the other hand, wanted to distinguish itself as a family-friendly service, so it had moderators, all these user content rules. And both of those services were sued for defamation arising from third-party content within a few years of each other in the early 1990s. And CompuServe's lawsuit was dismissed because it was found to be the distributor of content, and it had no reason to know that this material was defamatory. Prodigy, however, was held to not be a distributor. And this was just one court on Long Island, and it actually, as I document in the book, was not really one of the best judges in the United States. He had a pretty bad track record. So I disagree with his conclusion, but he said that because Prodigy took steps to edit and moderate content, it's held to be a publisher. So it's held liable just as much as if Prodigy made the statement itself.
And was that pulling off of the idea, say, if you're a newspaper, you publish an article and then you publish a letter to the editor where somebody says something defamatory, the newspaper would be considered the publisher of that as opposed to, you know, and hence potentially liable.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So Prodigy was found to be more like a newspaper and less like a newsstand. So therefore, it was strictly liable, just like a newspaper, for the letters to the editor. The fallacy in that argument is that Prodigy, a newspaper's letter to the editor page, runs maybe 5 or 6 letters a day, and they screen them, and every single one. Prodigy, even back then, had tens of thousands of user posts every day, and there was no way that they were screening everything. If they found something or if they got a complaint, they would take it down. But it was just pretty ridiculous to assume that Prodigy could moderate every single bit of content.
And then you get into, with those two separate types of decisions, then you create a situation where it makes sense either not to have comments at all or to just not say that, you know, if you're the platform, you're not going to do anything about it, because if the minute that you actually start dipping into them, you can be in trouble in a way that if you're CompuServe and you say, we don't care, we don't even look at this stuff, you're in the clear.
That's exactly right. So under that rule, at least from those two courts, the risk-averse way to handle user content would just be to take a hands-off approach. And that's what really caught the attention of Congress.
So, yeah, and now talk about the two guys behind Section 230 and describe the context a little bit, because, you know, now we're talking about the mid-90s. It's clear the internet is going to be a thing, and it's really funny to be talking about this, because for some of us, I think yourself, certainly myself, it's, you know, this isn't the past. This is like, you know, yesterday or something, yes. But it seems like it's shrouded in ancient myths of Avalon or something. But you have Chris Cox and Ron Wyden. One is a conservative, one is a Republican, one is a Democrat. You have a Congress, which this is a, you know, just after Bill Clinton has been elected, and then there are midterm elections where the Republicans end up taking control of Congress. It's a very fraught period, but you have these two characters who see something really special going on, and they want to carve out a space for the kind of online economy, online universe to grow. What was going on there, and how did they come up with 230?
So this was really in the spring and summer of 1995, and there was a lot going on that really led to this interesting confluence of events that caused Section 230 to be passed. So the first incident really occurred a few months before the Prodigy ruling, and that was there was a senator named Jim Exon, who was a conservative Democrat from Nebraska, very concerned about family values, and he proposed the Communications Decency Act, which would have basically
Words don't belong together, but yes, continue.
It would have criminalized the transmission of a lot of material online that was considered indecent, and it really had a very wide sweep. And there were a lot of civil liberties groups, technology companies, mm-hmm. that were very afraid of this bill that was moving through the Senate. It was getting attached to this massive overhaul of telecom laws that would be passed the next year. So Cox and Wyden, they saw this happening in the Senate, and they also saw the Stratton-Oakmont, the Prodigy decision, mm-hmm. and they realized that there needed to be a different path. And these were two members who had some technology expertise. Cox actually ran a translation service of the Pravda newspaper, so he used CompuServe and Prodigy. And they both represented districts that have a fairly heavy tech presence. So they realized that this new thing, this new internet, had a lot of potential. And I think really Cox was coming from it more of the perspective of, we don't want to regulate this to death. He was the fifth ranking Republican in the House. And Wyden also really, even though he's a fairly liberal Democrat, he also believes that the tech sector works best when it's not so heavily regulated. So they proposed what became Section 230, which basically said those 26 words, providing this broad immunity, as well as a separate provision that says that you're not going to be held liable if you take good faith steps to moderate or delete objectionable content. So those were both part of Section 230, and they attached their bill to the House telecommunications overhaul. And so the Exon bill is in the Senate, Cox Wyden is in the House, and then through the magic of conference committee, as a compromise, both of them end up getting attached to this Telecommunications Act that's signed in February of 1996. Mm-hmm. And the media coverage was almost all, it was really amazing. I spent a week just looking at media coverage of the Telecom Act, and almost all of it was about the regulation of local and long distance telephone rates, mm-hmm. and cable rates and things that nobody even knows about anymore.
And it's funny, in reading the book, you know, you're talking about MCI and Sprint. Yeah. I mean, these companies, some of which still exist, but most of which don't. Yeah. And it was, it's fascinating, again, how quickly, you know, you take a world for granted that, you know, these, and this is all the breakup of the Bell telephone. And, you know, these are giant companies that will be with us forever. And they already don't, you know, they're forgotten completely.
Exactly. And so most of the coverage was about that. Some of it was about the Communications Decency Act, the Exxon part that ended up getting a lot of attention, primarily because the ACLU and other civil liberties groups, the day that the bill was signed, challenged it in court. And then the next year, the Supreme Court struck down all of Exxon's indecency proposals. So what was left of the Communications Decency Act was Section 230. And even at that point in late 96, early 97, people didn't really know what those 26 words would mean.
So discuss, you know, the early cases where Section 230 became, you know, that was the focal point because people were bringing actions against platforms or websites. How did it play out in the first couple of legal challenges or you know, places where people were having court cases that involved 230?
So the first judge to ever decide a Section 230 case was actually Judge T.S. Ellis from Alexandria, who I think many people might recognize from the Manafort case. But he actually got the first case that would result in a Section 230 opinion. And that was a really tragic case involving someone named Ken Zarin, who he was a middle-aged photographer, real estate agent, living in Seattle with his parents. And about 6 days after the Oklahoma City bombing, he starts getting all of these really angry calls, starting maybe a few per hour, going to a few per minute. And what happened was someone, and we still don't know who, posted these incredibly tasteless ads with jokes about the Oklahoma City bombing and jokes about dead children on America Online and it said, "Ask for Ken, call," and they gave his phone number. And he took a lot of steps to ask AOL to take down these ads. And AOL dragged its feet. It delayed. Would take down one ad and then another ad would come back up and it wouldn't remove it fast enough. This went on for about a month. Zarin ended up going on psychiatric medication and it was really an awful experience for him. So he sues AOL, and AOL has the wisdom to hire Pat Garone, who's a really established great media lawyer in DC. And what a lawyer, so this was in late 96, early 97, what a lawyer typically would do is raise a First Amendment argument. But Garone has heard about Section 230, and he says, "Let's give this a shot." And Judge Ellis accepts his argument, and I think there were a lot of people who figured the Fourth Circuit, which is the appellate court, would reverse it because no one's ever interpreted this before other than Judge Ellis. But to AOL's luck, the panel on the Fourth Circuit, which at the time was a fairly conservative court, had one judge on the panel, J. Harvey Wilkinson, who's a Reagan appointee, but also a former newspaper editor. And he writes this very eloquent, lengthy opinion where he basically says Section 230 is meant to promote free speech and it prohibits a liability for online services. And so that became really the law of the land. And that has been the case cited more than any other Section 230 case. And that's really established this very broad protection for Section 230.
Why did AOL refuse to take the ads down or the comments? And again, this is, you know, for people now thinking about it, you know, AOL back then was known for being the place, if you wanted to have a private online presence, you would go to AOL because they didn't require you to demonstrate who you are in your communications. You know, everybody had fake names or whatever. But why didn't they just take down the offending material?
Well, from my review of the case files, which are fairly extensive with letters that Zarin and his lawyer had written, it seems like AOL did take some steps, but there was just frankly, a decent amount of incompetence at the customer service end. So Zarin,
well, that's the AOL we all remember.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't anything malicious. And Zarin also wanted things like a retraction or so, because I mean, there was a point where there was a disc jockey in Oklahoma City who read the ad online and that caused even more calls. So Zarin really wanted to get something on the record. AOL said, "We don't do that." I mean, frankly, AOL didn't know how to handle something like this. It was pretty clear that Zarin faxed them a letter, and it was about 2 weeks later that AOL responded. So I think that the pace of AOL's response was really a big problem.
You write at various points and in slightly different phraseology, but that the internet is different. And you talk about internet exceptionalism. What do you mean by that? And how did that kind of guide the way that 230 was being treated?
So Section 230 really embodies this idea of internet exceptionalism, which is that we need to treat the internet differently than other media because it poses this great potential for free speech and for the economy. And Section 230 really, at least as Judge Wilkinson interpreted it, really embodies this idea that we have to treat the internet differently. So we don't treat the internet like a letters to the editor section of a newspaper page, because the letters to the editor for a newspaper page don't pose the potential to create all of these jobs and free speech opportunities. So that's really the heart of at least how Section 230 was interpreted early on.
Is that part of it? Because unlike traditional media, say whether it's a TV station or a radio station or a newspaper, there seems to be an infinite amount of space. There's room for everybody.
Exactly. So it's more of a two-way or really a multilateral communication rather than just a one-way communication like a television or a newspaper page or a magazine. Right. And that was really the idea of what made the internet so different, is that you had this infinite potential for communication that you just didn't have on these other media. Right.
So you write the internet is different, or, you know, there's internet exceptionalism, but then you also write that Section 230 is really a uniquely American law. And at one point and I'm quoting from your book, you say, imagine a world in which Google were held legally responsible for a seemingly infinite number of websites that are indexed in its search engine. And that it's true, like it's a completely different world, that we would be in without it. But in many ways, that approach or that world is kind of like Europe and a bunch of other countries. Can you discuss how, say, the EU approach to internet speech freedom is different than the American? And which side do you, without becoming a jingoistic patriot, why is the American approach better? Which you definitively basically state in the book.
So America has always valued free speech above other values, such as privacy. I think that's probably the biggest contrast with the European Union in particular. They really view privacy and data protection as this fundamental human right that in the United States we don't. So in EU, just to give one example, they have the right to be forgotten, which allows people who are written about online under certain circumstances to have their certain search results de-indexed. So you could look at, and I mean, I'm somewhat equivocal on this because I can see it both ways. Having been a journalist, I've had some things written about me that I haven't liked all that much, and I would sure like to be able to easily take them down. But on the other side of the spectrum, I see the real benefits of being able to have this sort of unvarnished information out there, because that's really central to the American ideals of free speech. So for one example, if I'm an employer who's looking to hire someone, I probably want to know, if I can Google them, I'd want to know, have they been convicted of certain crimes? Have they been fired for wrongdoing before? If I'm the employee who wants to have a fresh start, that's a different story. So it really is a trade-off on these values.
You write that in the first decade of Section 230 lawsuits, the courts gave, mostly sweeping immunity to sites and services. It was very clear that they were taking this seriously. And in certain instances, kind of mind-boggling, even somebody like me, I'm a free speech absolutist and whatnot, and I'm kind of amazed that, that websites wouldn't get in trouble for having, people post fake accounts and then refusing to take the fake accounts down that just say terrible things about a person, etc. But the courts mostly ruled in favor of, the sites and maximum freedom. But then you say since kind of the mid-2010s, not so much. What's an example of the shift away from sweeping 230 immunity? And what do you think is driving that shift?
So I think part of it is the complexity, the increased complexity of services that are offered. So one example would be the roommates.com case from the Ninth Circuit. And this was a roommate matching website that allowed people to go online, create a profile, and state what they're looking for in a roommate. And some of the questions they asked were things like, what gender do you prefer? Do you prefer to have roommates who don't have children or who have children? And at least one housing nonprofit alleged that that was a violation of federal and state housing discrimination laws. So the Ninth Circuit issued a split ruling where it basically said, for anything that someone just goes and types in the open-ended sections of the ads, that's not that that's protected by Section 230 clearly. But for any ads that are developed in response to questions that solicit allegedly discriminatory responses, that is not protected by Section 230 because this is basically the website helping to create the content. And that really set this broad precedent that's been used in a lot of other cases of looking at whether these platforms materially contributed to the illegal content. And the irony of the whole thing is that once the case was argued on its merits, the Ninth Circuit found that there was no violation of the discrimination laws. So it was almost a case that didn't need to get to the Section 230 issues. But that's one area. And I think the other issue is that, frankly, the tech companies now are so much larger and more powerful than they had been in the past. And I'll say some of them have displayed a huge amount of arrogance. And you have to always remember Section 230 is inherently a creature of Congress. And there's an increasing reluctance to at least among some people, to saying, why would we provide this immunity to these large, arrogant companies that are, at least according to some critics, responsible for every problem in society? So that I think that's really what's driving a lot of this.
Yeah, you write that 230 is not a birthright of the internet, that it can be discarded, amended, limited, whatever. But you also do want it to persist. Can you talk about the future of 230? First off, why is it good? And, you know, one of the things that I'll as a parenthetical, I'll add, the book is extremely well written, and you tell, I mean, you're a journalist and a legal scholar and a lawyer. So, it's a really interesting mix of stuff, and you tell really fascinating and kind of perplexing stories in ways that are easy to follow. But why is it important? And one of the things you stress is that, you know, the harms to individuals who are being defamed or libeled in many of these cases is real, and it's problematic. And of course, people can always try and sue the person who is libeling them or defaming them, but it's hard to find those people often. But why is it important that 230 persist?
Because the current system that we have, the current internet that we have, is really built on Section 230. So rather than having a sweeping overhaul that really, I think, would have a lot of unintended consequences, what I would prefer to have is some sort of some more accountability and responsibility among the platforms to say, okay, we have these services that in some cases are being weaponized against individuals and causing some serious harms. But rather than just get rid of Section 230, which, by the way, won't even solve a lot of these problems if they get rid of Section 230, let's figure out a way to better justify why we have Section 230 in the first place. And I think that's hard. And I think that the tech companies have been reluctant to really engage in that discussion. But that's far preferable than just saying, okay, we're going to get rid of Section 230 altogether. Because as we've seen, when Section 230 has been abrogated, there are a lot of consequences arising from companies just being really risk averse and saying, okay, we're just not going to allow user content.
Are there ways to minimize harms caused to specific people without really strangling free expression, or do you have like a model law or a good example of where a good balance is struck?
Well, so I think the platforms have to be more thoughtful. And I think there are some examples that I give in the book. For example, Pinterest had a problem where there were a number of users who were posting content that promoted eating disorders. And Pinterest, I think they deserve a lot of praise. They went out of their way to work with the National Eating Disorders Association to come up with keywords that would be they'd be able to flag for content that perhaps wouldn't be appropriate for the site or that would require further review. And I think that's the really thoughtful type of moderation that Section 230 allows and actually enables. And right. we need to be seeing a lot more of that. It actually encourages, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that it was giving private platform space to develop what they wanted to have as the mores of their particular online community.
Exactly.
So why do you think, you know, clearly it seems like sites like Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, they're struggling with this. I mean, they spend an enormous amount of time to begin with and an increasing amount of time trying to police content, partly, and I'm assuming part of it is they don't want to alienate their user base. They also don't want to necessarily poke the legislators who might kind of screw them. But are they just bad at it, or are they... Or is it just it's too complicated a task?
So it's hard. And I would suggest anyone read Tarleton Gillespie's recent book, Custodians of the Internet, which really mm-hmm. goes into what moderation entails. And so it's not an easy task, and AI is not going to solve everything. And Facebook, frankly, is never going to hire enough reviewers to right. be able to catch everything. But they could be doing a lot better. I mean, there are some examples where, I mean, some things like the Facebook basically allowing discriminatory categories for its advertisements. That's something that could be fixed really easily. And that really requires more of a commitment to reviewing all of these procedures. And you're not going to catch every bit of harmful content. But you can make some structural changes that would prevent sort of these rapid fire negative headlines from constantly arising.
What do you think the role of a kind of broad based media literacy or a different approach to that? What's the role of that in all of this? You know, one of the promises of social media, I guess I'm dating myself here. I don't know if social media is Web 2.0 or Web 3.0 or something, but you know, it's part of it is the idea, and it's inherent in the early days of the internet, but that it's ultimately a user driven experience. And what social media does is it gives you vast tools as an individual consumer of content to say, I want more of this, I want less of this, you know, go to hell with this. How much of it is that, you know, what we need less than more laws or more rules are people who take more seriously their time on the internet and how they want to kind of curate their experience?
Yeah, so I think that really gets to a good point that Section 230 really is about user empowerment. I mean, that when you look at the legislative history, it's the idea that we want to empower the users by basically creating these market demands that pressure the platforms for certain things. So I do think that some of the harms can be dealt with through just sort of increased awareness, increased education. But I think some of the harms also, they often target people who might not even have any connection to the platform that are being harmed. There was a recent case in the Second Circuit where there was a man whose ex basically wanted to get revenge on him, went onto a dating app and basically just started posing as this individual and inviting hundreds and hundreds of people to his home and work, demanding sex very aggressively. This really was horrific, and it really ruined the guy's life. And that's the type of thing where I think anyone defending Section 230 has to take a hard look at that and say, how are the platforms going to stop this sort of thing from happening? Because I frankly, when I said at the beginning of this podcast that this might be an obituary for Section 230, that's really not an overstatement. I think you have all of these cases, and there's not really any clear answers to them, and there are people with incredibly sympathetic situations. So we really have to figure out how do the platforms take these things more seriously?
Yeah. When you look at the political situation, what do you see happening over the next, I don't know, you know, 6 months or a couple of years? I personally get really sweaty whenever, in general, when I hear conservative Republicans and kind of liberal or progressive Democrats kind of saying the same thing. And, you know, you're hearing that over Section 230. You know, Nancy Pelosi calls it a sweetheart deal. Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and others have called it that for Google and Facebook. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, I'd like to know any other issue where Nancy Pelosi and Ted Cruz agree.
Yeah. And of course, they agree for different reasons. And it's because Pelosi thinks Facebook was negligent so that it tipped the election, you know, towards Donald Trump. And Cruz thinks Facebook is ideologically motivated against conservatives. So but it's creepy, right? You know, that they're kind of saying they're singing the same song.
Well, I think that the discussion on Capitol Hill needs to be beyond just let's get rid of Section 230. It has to be then what? And that's not the discussion I've been hearing. So we get rid of Section 230. What happens next? Is that going to eliminate any perceived political bias? Is it going to stop the Russians from trying to interfere in our elections? I don't see necessarily the connection between the two. Now, I will say that at least the way Section 230 has been framed, often rightly so, is that it's a benefit to the large technology companies, which it is. But I think that we also have to look at sort of the daily ways of life where being able to communicate freely and openly benefits not just the technology companies. And that side of the story isn't necessarily being told.
How do you feel when, you know, just in the past year, we've had high level, and by high level, I mean like the CEOs of places like Google, Facebook, Twitter, going before Congress and saying, yeah, you know, it is time for us to be regulated. We'll help you write the regulations because you don't really understand what we do. And I mean, Mark Zuckerberg explicitly said this in congressional testimony that I'll help you write it. And you do realize that that means there won't probably ever be another Facebook. Are you okay with that? How do you deal with the question of kind of regulatory capture or, you know, the kind of public choice dimension to what's happening now?
Yeah, so I practiced law in D.C. for long enough to know that regulatory capture is real. And
it's spectacular.
It is. It's spectacular, especially when you have companies that are operating in a space where many members of Congress don't function on a daily basis. And I'll say that I'm not speaking on behalf of DOD or the Naval Academy, just on myself.
Sure.
But I'll say that there's sort of this related issue that I've been involved in of how do you make Congress smarter about technology issues? And there's this movement to revive the Office of Technology Assessment, which was actually closed in the 1990s, and it had scientists and engineers who informed Congress about technology issues. And that sort of thing would be vital before we have Congress working with the tech companies to create this morass of regulations. Part of what I'm concerned about is that any of these regulations will be palatable for perhaps the Googles of the world, but maybe not so palatable for the next Googles of the world. And that gives me real pause for concern.
So the final section of your book includes a bunch of biographical details, which are fascinating. You were born in 1978, and you talk about the role that these old, mostly forgotten now, I guess, pre-internet online services played in your life, a Prodigy, CompuServe, et cetera, in expanding your world. I guess I have two final questions. One is, like, is part of what's happening now is that all of the newness and the kind of utopian possibilities of the internet, you know, we're kind of over that now, and it's just the day-to-day thing, and these companies are kind of getting middle-aged, and you know, they're gigantic, and they're kind of bullies. They're no longer scrappy or whatever. They're so that you just get tired of this kind of stuff, and you want to you just want to make it easier to deal with less problems. It's just you know, the internet is a mature space, you know, it has to grow up. Is that you know, is that part of what we're seeing here? And then also, and this is a more pointed question, are you writing not necessarily an obituary for 230, but for the internet as you knew it as a kid? And that this is really kind of, you know, just an elegy for the internet you grow up with rather than the internet we deserve or should have?
Yeah, so I think that this very well could be an obituary for, really not Section 230, but for this open internet, because there have been, when you compare it to when I was growing up, there were harms, but they perhaps were not on the same scope and this level of publicity, because there frankly were, I think, about 40 million people on the internet worldwide as compared to 3 billion. So right. I think that's part of it. And I think that we don't it doesn't have to be a binary decision. We could mm-hmm. perhaps find a way to make the platforms more responsive and try to cut out some of the really bad stuff without shutting down the internet altogether. But that's hard because it's harder to make the internet exceptionalism argument anymore, because as you said, it's more established. It's more, it's perhaps in the eyes of many, it's not so exceptional anymore because it's such a fundamental part of our everyday lives that it really wasn't in 1996.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank Jeff Kossoff. He is the author of The 26 Words That Created the Internet. He teaches law and cybersecurity at the U.S. Naval Academy. Jeff, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks so much.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, anywhere you get your podcast on. And if you can, leave a comment and let us know how we're doing. Thanks so much for listening.